This podcast is brought to you by Zeno Mueller, three-time Olympian and gold medalist. Imagine a 20-second 2K PR by the end of this season, or even sooner. Elite rowing coach by Zeno Mueller is a competitive advantage. The ERG score is the SAT of rowing, so find out what Zeno Mueller can do for you. Make sure to use coupon 4STARS, F-O-R-S-T-A-R-S, for $200 off on any program he has in his website. Zeno is an Olympian and graduate from Brown University, coached by the legendary Steve Gladstone. He'll get you right, he'll get your 2K down, and he'll be a better athlete after his training. So make sure you tune in with Zeno and get some coaching at eliterowingcoach.com.
Chip talks about watching the documentary. I don't think I can physically watch that Athens win. That one struck a little bit too close to home.
On tonight's program, ladies and gentlemen, we have something that's going to make you sick.
Everyone, welcome to the 4STARS podcast. We are with the amazing Porter Collins. Porter Collins graduated from Brown University. He's a two-time Olympian, actor, father, good person, great person, I should actually say. Porter, how you doing?
I'm great. Good to be here.
That's awesome.
I'm usually talking sort of financial podcasts. This is my first rowing podcast. Happy to be on.
Oh, that makes me happy. But I do want to touch on your financial podcast. I actually watched it at like 3 o'clock this morning, and it really got the blood pumping. I'm not gonna lie, I felt like I was there. It was a great setup. I loved it a lot.
So I
might have to rewatch it and look at some of the other episodes that you've made. In the back, we do have The Big Short, and one of them is a guy.
I'll do it for you, Hamish Linklater.
Yes, Hamish,
a solid B-rated actor, but super nice guy.
Yeah,
and Dodgers fan like yourself.
That's about to say. So one of my favorite movies is 42, Jackie Robinson. Yeah. He played Ralph Brackett. And so I was like watching the thing, and I was like, this guy looks awfully familiar. I'm like, this has to be who I'm thinking about. And it was. And so gotta watch it. But anyways, more about that movie and what that means to you. If you could dive deep in that, that'd be great.
Yeah, you know, it was as you're seeing a video of my office here. You know, The Big Short is just another piece in my career, which I'm very proud of. You know, I got my Henley pictures in the background. I got my world championship medals over here. And, you know, I just I'm very blessed to have lived a pretty successful life and a happy life, lots of friends around. And it's been just another piece in the puzzle, I guess, in my career.
I did post a Q&A, and people want to know and hear from you. So,
all right, let's go.
We got some questions here, but I do want to dive deep into also your personal experience, you know, before Brown, right? Because you were at Salisbury, and you were 5C of the 8 junior national team leading into Brown. You finished third in 1993, all before I was born. I'm making you feel old. But you grew up in Connecticut, right? In Darien, Connecticut. And so Greenwich Crew is, you know, a big rowing program out there. What was that like just being an athlete in Connecticut at that time?
You know, this is before, obviously before you were born and before Greenwich Crew ever existed, I guess. And so I tell my origin story as a very modest beginning. I tried in high school. I was a freshman in high school, and I tried out for the golf team, and I got cut. And sure enough, the crew coach grabbed me by the ear and pulled me down to the boathouse, and that's where I began. So it starts from modest beginnings. And, you know, I fell in love with it quickly, and I figured out I was pretty good at it. And I had some great coaches there. A bunch of the coaches had gone to Brown. And so I guess it was only natural for me to follow in their footsteps. You know, it was that along with, you know, when I was a senior in high school, Zeno Mueller was a freshman at Brown, and he had his picture in, he had a big sort of spotlight on him in Sports Illustrated. And so I had that on my wall my senior year, and Brown hadn't won the national championship yet. And, you know, they had you know, were had sort of gone through their dark years in the early 90s. And so I was really excited to go to Brown. And then I obviously met Steve Gladstone, and, you know, both my mother and I were enamored with Steve. And it was an easy choice for me. So I didn't really want to go anywhere else.
He has done amazing things for rowing, and obviously he's the most successful collegiate rowing coach in the world in history. I don't know if there will ever be a coach like Coach Gladstone. He just retired from Yale. We don't know if he's going to stop coaching. He was coaching the U.S. team this past summer for the World Championships. So we'll see. You know,
one of the things that people talk about Steve is, you know, sort of a fantastic coach. But, you know, I think one of his greatest strengths is his as a recruiter. And someone asked him about his recruiting ability. And you know, he talked about how he really tried to underwrite and recruit the person. And, you know, if I think of myself, my junior or senior year in high school, you know, I walked into a lot of the other boathouses like, you know, Harvard, and, you know, they never returned my, you know, mail or number or phone call. You know, the moment I met Steve, you know, he asked me about my character and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, at that time I really hadn't pulled an ERG score that was decent yet. And, you know, I'd gotten cut from the junior national team my junior year. And so, you know, he saw something in me that I guess I didn't see yet. And so I think it's that ability as a recruiter that he was really so good. And so, you know, I eventually did pull a good ERG score. And that summer I did go on to, you know, the junior national team, and was one of the, obviously the better guys on that team. And sort of my career took off, my rowing career at least took off like a rocket ship after that. So he nailed it as a recruiter. So
he won the lottery with you, that's for sure. Speaking about the fact that you think that he's the best recruiter of all time, and he's looking at the character and who you are and not just about, you know, ERG scores. I'm sure that it's definitely a factor, but when he was talking about your character, what was he asking you about? Because when you ask an 18-year-old guy about their character, they're probably going to want to tell you, oh yes, I strive to be better every day, like, you know, those types of things. But what did he ask you?
Funny you ask that. It's probably a little over 30 years ago now that I went on my recruiting trip, and I can still remember it like it was yesterday. And we were sitting there at the head of the Connecticut, all the boats had launched, and it was just he and I sitting there on the boat trailer talking about, you know, who I was and what I wanted to do, and, you know, what sports I played. I played three sports in high school. And, you know, my academic track record is, you know, I'd gotten better grades every year, and was really on a sort of on an ascent. You know, I think it was in rowing that I really found my confidence, and that confidence translated to, you know, not just rowing, but translated to playing football and playing, you know, other sports, and then translated into my grades, and sort of it all mirrored itself in terms of taking a different turn in my life. And that confidence really gave me, you know, was really the shot in the arm that say, hey, I can do this, I can do things. And from there, you know, things just started snowballing, and, you know, becoming learning how to become a leader along the way. You know, I was captain of you know, two sports in high school. I was captain of the Brown team for 2 years. And so, you know, becoming a leader, and then, you know, I think I like to think I was a leader on those national team boats, and just putting myself in those shoes and being a person, you know, who teammates could trust and work hard. And, you know, those same principles followed me from not only, you know, from the classroom to the water, but to eventually to, you know, when I had to get a job and work on a team. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons I was so successful at, you know, in the working world. It was, you know, life off the water was pretty easy for me, right? In terms of, you know, I already knew how to work hard. I knew how to assimilate with the team, and I knew how to, you know, find where I was going. And so those same principles stuck with me from rowing. So rowing weeds out the weak, right? You know, if you're a survivor and you can deal with all that stuff, you know, that's why, you know, I found when I went to the national team, you know, all the guys that are even in college, all the guys were like me, and they all fought like me, and they all trained like I did. And, and they all had a similar way of life. And so, you know, it was there's some really fantastic years of training with those guys. So, you know, and listen, the things about failure are true. You know, we all fail. It's just about how we respond to that. And, you know, I think a long time ago, a coach always said, you know, you want to train like the guy that you hate to race against. Right. And I used to do that. You know, I would do this 20-minute erg before practice every day when I got to Brown. And one day I was sitting there and I was like, yeah, I think I'm just going to go for this. And so it's like some of my fall, my freshman year. And I break 6K for 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, I was so excited. I go down, Scott Roop. I just broke this, this time. And he's like, yeah, it's great. Port, hop in the boat. And so sure enough, it's a, 3-4 hour workout. And then followed by, we call them bear bars, but those are sort of off the water circuits we do. So, you know, we're out there for training for, between 3 and 5 hours a day. And then, you know, we would sit there for all freshman fall. We would sit in eights and row by sixes, even boats, and just, you know, battle against each other for hours. And so it's that sort of lunch pail mentality that I always brought and I always rode with. And I think that's one of the reasons I was so successful as a rower. You know, I wasn't necessarily the biggest guy. I was, 6'5", but I was kind of scrawny and, I rode fine, but I wasn't a beautiful technical rower. I was just dogged. And so, if all else fails, just pull hard, right? So that was always my motto.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
I like that motto right there. There's a lot of great mottos that in this sport we call rowing. What is your favorite rowing motto that you've heard or try to portray every day?
I don't know if I have a motto, but if I had a mantra to live by, I guess, it's sort of the get after it, attack the day. That's what I do. I get up every morning and whether it's whether I'm rowing or whether I'm trading stocks, I'm into it. And or if I'm being a dad or if I'm being a coach, you just sort of got to get after it. And so that's and sometimes you fail, like you said, but it's you got to pick yourself back up and try again. And so that's my mantra, I guess.
Now, when you say you were cut from the golf team, was it the tryouts that was the part that?
Oh, I think we played like 3 rounds and I sucked, I didn't suck, but I was not good enough to make the golf team, that was about it. I don't think it was any in depth situation.
Okay, I see what you mean. Going to Brown, you're there, you're a freshman there, and I talked to Zeno about this actually, and I said, Zeno, what haven't you heard about? That's been talked about on my show, and he says, you haven't talked about when the athletes go from high school to college and they're living in college and they're there with no parents and they're in these dorms with all these strangers that they meet on the first day of school. At Brown, when you got there, were you with your teammates? And if you weren't with your teammates, how did you make sure your dorm mate was understanding that you had to be up at the crack of dawn to practice every day?
I had gone to boarding school. So, the living alone was, it was not a big deal for me once I got to college. I was, again, it was all pretty easy. I lived with this guy, Jeb Besser, and who's still the hardest rowing guy I know, but he wasn't a recruit and he was a complete walk-on and rode at Nobles. And I think he'll admit he rode probably in the last boat at Nobles. And, for better part of 3 years at Brown, he was in the last boat at Brown. And, no one worked harder than Jebber. And, Jebber keeps at it. And I believe he won the Head of Charles this year and he wins pretty much every year. So I surrounded myself with people who were just determined to win and to show up. And, you know, you go to Brown and people don't really care if you're a rower or not a rower or a hockey player or whatever. They're just sort of all the same, or at least that's the way it was when I was there. So
someone did ask you, does the number 5 haunt you at all?
Not really. You know, I could feel sorry for myself that I got 2 fifth place finishes in the Olympics, or I could feel really proud about, you know, from where I started to where I finished. And I chose to take that route. And, you know, if there's a lot of coulda, shoulda, wouldas and a lot of oh, poor is me type situations I could have gone down, but I never went down that one. And, you know, as evidenced by my real career after rowing, you know, I was ready to get after it and I was ready for the next stage of my life and to figure out what it was and to figure out my path and, you know, how to best get from A to B. And I'd done that before in a previous life and got from A to B pretty successfully. And, you know, it might not have been punctuated the way I wanted to, but, you know, that's not the way life works. And, a lot of times it's not fair. And so, you know, we didn't race we weren't our fastest, in 2000, you know, as the movie shows, there was a lot of bad stuff going on. We just weren't fast at the end of the day. You know, I think that in 96, I probably had a better shot of winning a medal. We had won the heats and beat the Germans, who eventually won the silver medal. I think we beat them by a length in the heats. And in the final of the 96 Olympics, we just had a bad start. And we got sort of a length down to the field, you know, in the first 200 meters and could never really catch up. Sort of spun our wheels a bit. You know, it all goes by so quickly, you know, and that 6-minute race, you wait, you know, 4 years to race a 6-minute race and you're down in the first 40 seconds. And sure enough, that those meters tick by pretty quickly. So, you know, I guess it teaches you, you know, you really gotta, you know, be ready, being there. I was telling this story to my son the other day, sort of a bit aside, but, you know, in 96, we were doing these pair trials and, first they did a time trial and Ted Murphy and I came in second in the time trial. And Jamie Coven comes up to me and goes, man, Porter, you know, you guys look so good. I don't know if I can, you know, even stick with you guys in the heat, you know, we're right next to each other. You're great. You know, just congratulations. And sure enough, he totally rope-a-doped me in the heat. You know, we're lined up and, you know, sort of before the word said go, Jamie and his pair partner are out of there. I mean, they're like a length and a half up on us. And we eventually never caught him, but we finished second. And you know, he totally rope-a-doped me. He played the mind game of on me, and he knew exactly what he was doing. Thankfully, we beat him in the final. But you know, it just one of many life lessons along the way, and mind games people play. But you know, Jamie played him better than anybody. So. By the way, it's Jamie Coven, probably the best. Well, I guess he's the only living world champion, American world champion in the single at this point. So I did get to row with Brian Volpenheim and Chris Aaron, so probably the two most famous rowers in our country. So
everyone shows that one clip when he won in 2004. He's putting his two hands, these two fingers out, talking to him. Nobody knows what he's saying. Or maybe they do. They still want to tell me what he's saying. But you know that clip I'm talking about?
I, you know, there's some things you can't go to. And Chip talks about watching the documentary. I don't think I can physically watch that Athens win. That one struck a little bit too close to home.
Oh, wow. So you never watched that, like that video before?
I've seen a clip or two of it, of them crossing the finish line, but that one kind of hurts. Man. It was Teddy's redemption race, as well as Chip and Chris and Brian. So good for them. I couldn't be happier for them. So
I talked to Zeno a little bit about preparation for the Olympics, but for your, you know, you were there twice, he was there three times, but for you, you're there twice. And I wanted to know if there's any way that you can enlighten the viewers about what it took to prepare, like not just the training, but like the the sleep or the diet or things like that that goes on, you know, behind it all?
Well, I think one of the things that I think, you know, people know about diet and all that type of stuff. And I think one of the things that Mike Spracklin did was he did a lot of visualization and talks about, you know, you just have the coxswain or if you're in a non-coxswain boat, you know, sort of visualize your moves, visualize your warm-ups. And so by the time you get there, you're really ready and have a complete sense of what's going on. You know, I think one of the things, and I've read books on this and in terms of how to try to control those your emotions and the adrenaline going through your body. And, you know, it's mostly the adrenaline that, you know, obviously gives you the butterflies and gives you the upset stomach and gives you the, you know, the anxiety. And, you know, think about Bob Beamon and his world record jump in the 68 Olympics in Mexico City, you know, the record that wasn't broken for another, I think it was like 40 or 50 years, you know, to be able to channel yourself in that moment of your, you know, your greatest, you know, achievement or greatest, you know, opportunity for achievement. You know, I like to think that I was ready for that race. You know, again, in 2000, we just, you know, we had so many changes in the lineups and so many things and so much, you know, wear on our tires at that point, through multiple, injuries and moving around the lineups and, you know, in and out of the hospital and all these type of things that it just, we weren't fast enough so that it wasn't a preparation things. We just weren't, in 2000, we weren't fast enough. But, you know, again, in, you know, 98 or in 95, when Chip talks about on his podcast, when we won the, you know, the world championships, I actually want to touch on Chip's call in the 1995 world championships. We had lost to the New Zealanders in the heats, and we had a notoriously fast start in that boat. Chris Ahrens, Ben Holbrook, myself, Scott Munn, and Pete Cipollone. And we'd got up and these older Kiwis who were in the previous Olympics sort of had rode through us right at the kind of last 400 meters. And so we knew this going into we won the rep pretty easily. And then going into the final, we knew that we'd get out fast. They'd come back to us and we'd have to go again. And so, so with 400 meters to go, you know, sure enough, they pull even to us. And Chip goes, you know, he preps the move and says, if you want to win, you got to go now. And I mean, if you look at the video, the boat just starts surging ahead. And we ended up winning by a length, and it was pretty awesome. It was, you know, that was one of the, I still remember Mike Tatey's pre-race speech, and he's talking about, you know, this is your opportunity to become a world champion. You know, anything else in your life, you know, they can take it all away from you, but, you know, but you'll always have on your tombstone, Porter Collins, world champion. And so, you know, steam's coming out of my ears and I'm just ready to go. And so by the time Chip makes the call in the last 400 meters of that race, you know, we were stomping on it pretty good. That was a fun one.
I was about to ask you, what is your favorite Cipollone call?
You know, he's had some really good ones. He, in 1998, he had one where, if you remember, half of you probably won't remember it, but in the summer of 1998, there was this home run derby contest between McGuire, Sosa, and I forget the third one. But, you know, we had this big move, and I think it was maybe 900 meters in, and you know, he calls for the Mark McGuire Grand Slam move. And it's something he just kind of thought off the cuff. And so, you know, there's a video going along and there's a bridge about, call it 6 strokes into our 20 stroke move. And so the camera blocks out for, you know, 3 or 4 of the strokes. And so we're coming through the bridge of this stroke of this piece. And by the time that we pop out of the bridge, we're like you know, six seats up on him, moving out to a length out. And so that was a good one. And then in the 99 World Championships, it was a little skewed by the lanes and the wind, but you know, we had gotten up to open water. Brits came all the way back and were leading us at 500 meters. And, you know, we kind of knew that we'd need to work on our sprint a little bit in the heat, which was fine. We'd won, but it was a little bit faulty. And, Chip makes a big call, and, you know, just the boat, you can see it in the video, just it surges. And it was like, we were trying to break the boat in half as we went into the final 500. It was great. That was a fun one.
You realize that there's a power that, you know, Pete Chipolone had when he was with you all. Like, he was, I would say, you know, a vital force on that team. And he even said he was one of the leaders on the team. He wasn't the leader. He was one of them. And as a leader, right, you try to teach your children, you know, how to be a leader and how to stand up for themselves and fight for what's right.
You know, I've had some great coxswains in my career. You know, Steve Segaloff was the coxswain at 96, and you know, he was fantastic. And then Pete and Raj Shah was our coxswain in at Brown, and she ended up going on to be the women's coxswain in the 2000 Olympics. So I was blessed with some great coxswains. You know, there's some great coxswain stories if you're in of the Mike Tatey late 90s regime, where, you know, Mike was sort of Mike was really himself, and you know, he used to, it was so you know, it was very entertaining for us as rowers, that sort of we got a good laugh when he would go after the coxswains, mostly for not steering straight, which, you know, Pete was probably, he probably won the seat by just being the only coxswain could actually steer straight. But you know, I think he talked about it, if you were over cadence, you know, no matter if it was the stroke's fault, the coxswain would get crushed for it. Chris Ahrens would never, you know, 20 strokes a minute, Chris would always be at like 22, and you know, Pete would yell it at him to get it down, because he knew he was going to get crushed. But you know, Pete was, he was just a great friend, and he was there for everybody, and you know, he really understood, you know, what he could empathize with the rower, even though he was not, you know, kind of going through the day-to-day training of being, you know, dog tired or mentally exhausted or whatever it was. You know, he could really empathize with the rowers, and you know, so to be able to call on them when he thought he could, but not push them when, you know, they thought they were at the end of the rope or whatever. So you know, Pete was an amazing coxswain, as well as an amazing guy. Not they're the same thing. So
you get to the Olympics and you're there, and you wake up in the morning, and it's, as you say, it's time to get after it, and you're on the line. I want to know what he was telling you. What was he telling you when you were on the, you know, as he getting his bow straight, and he's, you know, looking down the race course and looking over and whatnot? What were some of the things besides, you know, breathe or take a deep breath that you hear coxswain say before?
You know, I'm not going to remember the exact words, but you know, I think that, you know, Pete's a very fun-loving, affable guy, but he also has the serious mode where he gets on and is very, you know, serious Pete. And serious Pete always showed up in race day. And, you know, obviously the Cox's number one job is to, you know, get the warm-up done and show up on the line on time, so, you know, the athletes aren't scrambling to, you know, be late or, you know, sit in the line too early, and, you know, get locked in. And so, you know, the coxswain's job, you know, prior to the actual race is just to execute the easy stuff, right? Showing up on time, not hitting anything. And then obviously when you get on the race course is to go straight and then make the calls when you need to make the calls. You don't necessarily have to make them with the Pete Chipolone type amazing calls or motivational calls, but just to you know, make sure you're have the crew in rhythm. You know, the one of the hardest things about the eight is you got to organize eight people, right? And organize the you know, the hands away together, all the stuff and you know, just making those simple calls of how to improve the rowing a little bit or how to improve the synchronization. I think that's a sort of the big things about the coxswain. And Pete sort of did all those. You know, he was tactical, he was you know, he was emotional with us, and he did all everything in between. So he was great, as well as the other coxswains the really good ones I rode with.
It's fantastic.
And of course, there's some bad coxswains along the way too. So which is equally funny and memorable. But you know, whether it's hitting a bridge or whatever, so it's all part of the sport.
Hitting a bridge is crazy for. Yeah. That's crazy.
Happens all the time.
I know it does. You see clips of Head of the Charles and coxswains at, you know, the youth level, even college. Just, you know, it's like everyone's just colliding into another. It's like Legos in a sense. But so you're at the start line, and you know, you hear the buzzer and it goes off, and you know, you're sending it down the race course. Your thoughts. You hear the coxswain's voice. Sometimes you just it goes on autopilot and you're just going, right? But you hear the voice. Was there something that you talked to yourself before the race about, maybe thinking about, or a motivation internally to kind of, you know, to send you into a different trance because Chip Alone talked about the fact when you're in a race, everything kind of goes on autopilot at a certain point. And so you don't really even hear the coxswain for them. A lot of times you hear it, but it kind of goes over your head. And
I think one of the things that I like to stress here is that, you know, the race day is just a culmination of everything else that's happened, right? You can't show up to race day and expect to be a different person than you were in training, right? So, you know, whether it's, you know, work or in rowing, you know, all the hard work is done before, and all the preparation and all the miles that you put in, you know, Scott Roop always would say, you know, miles make champions, right? And, you know, putting in those miles and putting in, you know, the drilling and all this type of eating right and working out and lifting weights and stretching, you know, all that preparation leads to race day. And you know, all you have to do on race day, then, if you've done the work, is execute, you know, like in, if you're fast, you know, like in rowing, you know, the funny thing is, you know, speed kills, right? If you're fast, you know, like, you know, all you have to do is execute your race and your race plan, and you're just going to be hard to beat, right? And you know, you can't expect miracles, especially in an eight on race day. So
you can't expect miracles, but you hope to make one.
You hope to make one. That's sure, you know, like, but if, you know, again, if you've, you know, these, you know, look at these, you know, the Cal or, you know, these crews today, you know, like, they're just faster than other people, right? They got bigger, faster, stronger guys. They put in the work and they're just faster. And so, like, you know, they even in a bad race, sometimes they can still win. And so, you know, look at the, you know, when we were at Brown, my freshman year, we just, you know, we had more talent. We were, we definitely worked harder and we had more fun and we just beat everybody. And that was the year where there wasn't a boat in the entire boathouse that lost a race, whether it was heat, final, whatever, you know, whether it's, you know, all the way from the head races all the way through to the IRA, every boat had won. It was crazy.
Yeah. I was about to mention the fact that your freshman year, you think, and I believe as well, is undisputably the best freshman class in rowing history. And that rowing class that you were a part of, it's amazing how all these different athletes can come from different programs around the world and all come together. And in less than 1 year, because you think about it, it's not really a full year, right? You're there for a couple months in the fall, then you come back for after winter break and you're there for the spring. But all of you came together and made it work. And you found yourself with everybody else and everyone was feeding off of one another and you were just putting in the work and that really helped with the results. And
well, I think what Brown did in the early 90s, and they were the first one to do it, just, you know, we just worked harder than other people. Right. And
but how, though?
You know, Scott Roop was a our coach was a world champion in the lightweight single skull, and he was just a scrappy, you know, lunch pail, hardworking guy. And he got to where he was, and he was actually Jamie's coach in the world championships in the single. He got to where he was because of hard work. And, you know, Scott notoriously just put in more hours, put in more strokes. And, you know, we were there, you know, always the last ones to leave the boathouse. We'd got always got the dinner right as the dinner line closed. And, you know, it was sort of that simple. That was the, you know, he was freshman coach for 3 years and won three straight freshman, you know, undefeated seasons. I mean, they lost one race the year before I got there. But other than that, you know, he wiped the floor with everybody. And again, it was just hard work. The year before us, he didn't have the talent that they had in Jamie's and Zeno's year or my year. But you know, they still were really good.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were unbelievable. And the fact that Mike Spratlin asked to join the national team after your sophomore year at Brown is unbelievable as well. Because most guys in their sophomore year of college, they're at U23s, right? They're doing that, but they're trying to bring you up to the national team, the big boys. And I'm sure there were other athletes involved with your class that were going to U23s. Because correct me if I'm wrong, those were around, right?
They did have U23s, but you know, it was like everything back then. It was a little bit more. It wasn't as organized, I guess. But you know, the thing about, you know, one of the reasons I was called up so early, I guess, is that, you know, that you know, we had, you know, we were training so hard. We just, our boathouse had all the fastest erg times around. You know, I had, you know, Jamie and myself and a couple other guys at Brown were sort of the first college guys around to break 6 minutes. Right? And I did it my freshman year, but you know, that just didn't happen at the time. And so, you know, I always had a good erg score. And then when it came to, you know, I'd never really rode a pair, and I showed up to the Mike Spracklin's, you know, training camp in San Diego. And I was just, you're forced to learn. Right. And another guy who put in some tremendous hours of hard work. And when I lived out there in San Diego up to the 96 Olympics, you know, we'd rode three times a day. We'd rode in the morning at 11 o'clock. We would do just sort of steady state for an hour, and then come back and row again at 4:30 or whatever. And you know, that's a long existence of a full year of doing 3 days. It's just a total grind. And you know, obviously an environment that I thrived in. So
who taught you how to be competitive though? Is that just how you were raised? Were you raised in a competitive house? Or,
you know, it's a good question. I think some of it is inherent in who we are, but you know, a lot of it can be learned too, right? And it's, you know, I like to say it's the discipline to be able to do that, to do the hard work when, you know, you don't really want to do the hard work, right? And that's the discipline, and that's the discipline that can be learned, right? And eventually, you know, I got to a point, I think, in my rowing career where I was, you know, in such good shape that, you know, even doing hard workouts wasn't all that bad. You know, and I, you know, I had the, you know, the capacity to do, you know, these crazy hard workouts, and, you know, it wasn't like a death sentence. You know, sometimes, you know, now if I got on the, you know, the erg to do some of those workouts that I used to do, it'd be a complete death sentence. So, and you know, the erg itself is a torture machine, but, you know, I think once you get to a fitness level, it's not really as bad of a, it's still a torture machine, but it's not as bad, I guess.
My personal favorite scene was when you were, had that entire, contraption on you, and you were doing your 2K, and the connection with your teammates was so strong. You could hear it, and you could hear everyone pushing you, and all of this yelling, and even Tate, you know, patting your back at the end, telling you great job and all these different things. And even you even saw with Brian Volpenhayn, I think it was indoor sprint or something that they were doing. Mike was cheering him on at the end and just, you know, slapped his shoulder, telling him good job, and you could just see Brian's face just all light up and whatnot. There's a power of external motivation that we see in rowing, not always in other sports, but I really do think keeps everyone coming back to the boathouse every day.
I mean, there's the yes, but let's not kid ourselves. We were motivated by a lot of fear of Mike Tatey and, you know, a fear of Mike Spracklin out there to not let them down. For whatever reason, I was good at those VO2 tests with, you know, the snorkel tube test and your nose pinched. I was able to sort of drown out the noise of and the fear of all that stuff. There was another speed order camp that we went to when I was in college and Mike was first on the national team. And you showed up and had to do a 6K and then went out and rode and did seat racing. But for the 6K, I got on the machine and I was next to all the good guys. And halfway through my 6K, the monitor started blinking and I wasn't sure if it was recording everything, and it would kind of go in and out for, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes at a time. And the coxswain's waving his hand and for Mike to come over, and Mike tells him to shut the fuck up. And, you know, I just kind of kept rowing, and I finished the piece and I was like, oh man, I hope this shows up. And so Mike goes over, hits the thing, and sure enough, the time pops up. And Mike's like, see, that's how you fucking do it. You don't fuck. Did he fucking freak out? He didn't freak out. He just fucking kept rowing. And so, you know, it's the fear of Mike Tatey was always around. And, you know, too bad that, you know, the world's gone a little bit woke or a lot woke, maybe, I guess, in terms of motivation of rowers and everybody.
It's pathetic. It's pathetic. So, it's pathetic.
Rowing's a hard sport. And, you know, if you want, you know, good results, you got to have hardened rowers. So, and hardened athletes.
It sucks though, because there's a difficulty that I see, because I'm coaching juniors now. And there's so many things that you can't, or not, I won't say you can't do, because you can do anything. But there are so many things that, like, parents are probably one of the worst things in junior rowing, because all they do, they have no idea what the sport is like, but they have so much input. They have so much to say. And it's like, I'm here to coach your son or daughter to be a better athlete every day. And yes, your advice means a lot to me, so I can, you know, be a better coach. But it's not because of me. It's about, you're trying to tell me how to do, you know, my job, which is not really the best way to do it. And you said you had fear of Mike Tatey. That's been something that I want to dive into a little bit in this episode, but I definitely want to talk about the fact that parents, because you're a dad, you're coaching your son. There's some parents in that their children are mortified by their parent, and they're scared of not being able to go to these great schools that their parent is telling them, you have to do this, you have to get this ERG score, you have to be this fast. And it's like, first off, you're not doing it. Second of all, I know I have to be faster. Third of all, it's, I don't need you to keep on pestering me about this when I have my coach doing it to me every day at practice. So it's, sometimes there's these people that are just keep on nagging you all the time. And I don't believe all the time. It's pretty important to do that to a, you know, someone who's maturing and, you know, their brain's not even half developed yet.
Yeah. I also had great role models in terms of my parents. You know, my both my mother and father were extremely hardworking people, and my mother's definitely dogged, and you know, I some, you know, some sense of fear of both of them. And so, you know, whether it's your parents, whether it's God, whether it's your coach, whether whatever, you know, the fear is a real motivator. And you know, not to fail, and you know, it you know, maybe that's the jump start. And then as confidence builds and as success builds, you know, like, hey, I'm pretty good at this and I can do this. And I want to, it's a natural progression to see, hey, let's see how far I can take this, you know. And then I think the really good ones are able to push it. And then when they fail or hit roadblocks or hit a hard coach or whatever it is, they're able to not only, you know, thrive through that, but really accelerate and grow from all that. And, you know, so that's what I found.
There's a power of a coach to keep you on your feet every day. And there's also a level of respect that a coach can teach you about when you show up to the boathouse. You can't be showing up to the boathouse, you know, looking like you just rode out of bed. Granted, there's been rowers that do that, and they're great athletes, and they can, you know, they can switch their mentality right there when they get in the boat.
I had this coach in high school named John Lindbergh, and John was a brown rower, and he was after high school. I think he played semi pro hockey for a couple of years, and so he was a real tough guy. And so, I'm going off to the junior team camp, and he's like, Porter, I want you to show up in the crappiest, you know, rowing shorts, the crappiest t-shirt you have. And the first day you show up, you get in the boat, and they're like, who's this guy? And you go up and you beat the absolute living shit out of them. He goes, you very low expectations. You know, you don't want to put in the flashy unisuit, and, you know, cause then people are going to have expectations of who's this guy. Right. And so, you know, if you show up and they don't know you're coming, and you come and hit them as hard as they can, they're gonna be like, wow, who's this guy that shows up with, you know, the, you know, ratty t-shirt is kicking the crap out of me right now. So, coaches that I've been blessed throughout my life and have all these coaches and have had these wonderful experiences that all taught me a lot along the way. And I could easily be angry at Mike for, you know, probably screwing up the 2000 Olympic regime as badly as he did, but I love him. And, I've taken so much from him and so much from his teachings that, you know, I owe him a lot, and a lot of gratitude, as well as a lot of the other coaches that have coached me along the way. So,
you're not stubborn about it. You're not stubborn about what happened. Cause I mean, there's people out there that wonder, like, the therapy that you must have gone through after that Olympics.
I think the only thing that really kind of hurt me a little bit was when they won 4 years later. Like, oh, come on, guys. So that was the, like, other than that, you know, like, I don't know, it's just life. You move on. And, you know, I had my eyes set on a career after that. You got to remember that, like, you know, none of us are going professional in rowing, right? And this is all just, you know, if we're lucky enough to get into these fantastic universities and get fantastic education through the sport of rowing, like, it's a win. And so I considered it, you know, a win for me getting into Brown University, and then, you know, making these amazing friends along the way at university who are still, you know, some of my best friends in life. And then, you know, the guys on the national team, are some of my best friends in life. And so look at all the sport had given me. And for me to say that, you know, yeah, I lost one race. Yeah. Maybe it was a big race, but, you know, it's not the right way to look at it. So that's how I think about it. And listen, I have 3 world championship gold medals. Yeah, I guess that's a heck of a consolation prize.
We're talking about the fear of Tatey. There's a section I want to input in this episode about the fear, because people always talk about how he's this, how he's that. If you could just talk a little bit more about him.
For some reason, I think it's easier to tell through stories. There was a, I had taken the 96 or 97 world championships off, because I had rowed a lot up until 96, and obviously rode 3 times a day, and then came back to, then, you know, the Olympics were over, and kind of went right back into school and Brown. And I was sort of tired and needed a little bit of break from rowing, and actually wanted to get some real world experience. And so I went and worked in New York City for the summer, and then came back in 1998 for the camp. And I was clearly probably one of the best guys there, but, you know, Mike Tatey really wanted to, you know, make it known that he was in control and he was ruling things. And so I had gone to Mike and I said, Mike, you know, I'm going to come to camp, but, you know, the first week we get there, it's like my grandmother's 90th birthday, or whatever, I forget where it was. And so I was going away for the weekend. And so I go away for my grandmother's 90th birthday and come back, and it's like Sunday night, and we show up, and he's like, all right, we're fucking seat racing. And he switched me with like every guy in the program for 10 races. And he goes, "See, Porter, you won't go away your fucking grandmother's birthday next time." And so, you know,
no person in well.
So anyways, there are all these great stories along the way that, you know, I don't even, you know, the fear of Mike Tatey was real. And, you know, I don't think that stuff happens anymore today, but, you know, I in a weird way, I probably enjoyed it. So whatever.
Any more stories?
Oh, there's millions of stories.
Can you share a couple more? I'll ask a couple more.
No, that's if they come up to me, I'll share them along the way. But they're pretty good. Like the more fun stories for me was when I wasn't the personal end of it, where he would, you know, if he was crushing a coxswain or a lightweight or a guy who, you know, in the three and pause drill would go, you know, four and pause. You know, he would there's nothing worse than if you're in, you know, watch Mike would do three and he would do a lot of pause drills. And so, you know, you do one and pause, two and pause, three and pause. And then inevitably someone would fuck it up and he'd pull the boat, you know, the launch right up to the boat and just be in your ear. Those are some good ones.
He's got in the face of certain athletes. They show up to the practice and like, it's the fucking Olympic year. Like, it only happens one time every 4 years and you're showing up and it's just like,
I've blocked out some of those memories or probably a lot of those memories, but it's, they're all, I guess the only the runs I remember are the good ones at this point. So probably better that way.
Cause his pre-race talks, Chip talk about like, if it doesn't go well, just keep going north or something like that.
Yeah, that was, I think that was the one where they went to the head of Charles and like if you don't win, just keep rolling north. Yeah,
it's just, I don't know. I think it's just that generation that he was a part of, just had this energy and just, they just had no care in the world. They just said whatever they felt and they were very impulsive, but they just said it, and a lot of people related to it or they didn't relate to it. You know.
Yeah, the guys who did well under the Mike Tatey program. You know, they complain, but they don't really have any bad things to say about him. You know, the guys that got cut or that sucked at rowing, you know, are always the Greg Ruckmans of the world that hated him, right? And you know, that's shocker. That's what happened, right? So I think Greg Ruckman still has lawsuits against him and U.S. Rowing, or what, I forget the whole story. But
I would say something that really inspired me about you is that you are a man of God and you use that in your life to keep you going. And I think that talking about God is a very important part of my life and how I was raised and things like that. And I believe that in the documentary, your teammates had touched on the fact of how close you are to God. And I definitely want to touch on that. I think it's an important part of who you are.
You know, I would say religion and religious studies were a big part of, you know, who I was as a kid. And I can't say I'm the most devout and religious person in the world, but, you know, God has definitely played a big role throughout my life and you know, asking big questions, whether it's, you know, asking big questions to myself or to God or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, always looking for the extra motivation along the way, especially when things are down, right? When things go against you and you inevitably lose races or go through tough times, you know, you need to dig down and you know, find whatever support you need to springboard yourself to the next level, right? And you got to be able to use those tough times as motivation, as reflection, you know, for better times ahead. Otherwise, you know, what are we all doing around here, right? So I'm not going to wallow in misery. You know, I'm going to try to look for inspiration in any way I can find it. And so that's the way I think about it.
One of the greatest things about being a man is, and one of the most important thing in life as a man is to be a good father. And what are some of the things that you teach your son?
It's been, you know, fun for me. I sort of, aside from the annual head of the Charles racing, I'd sort of given up the sport. And, you know, I had work and family and all sorts of stuff that people will figure out that takes a lot of your time away. You when I was rowing on the national team and everything, you know, all you had to worry about was yourself and getting down to the boathouse. Now, you know, you have to worry about, you know, the kids, wife, yourself, job. A lot of stuff gets in the way. And so I didn't really row for the better part of 20 plus years. And my son's now in high school, and I get to, you know, get to row with him, get to teach him. And I think a lot of it's just leading by example, you know, doing things the right way, you know, obviously help motivating him to, you know, in everyday life and in school, and, you know, make sure to just to, you know, trust the process of growing up, because, you know, things can be very volatile as a teenager, and a lot of emotions going through. But, you know, you just kind of have to trust the process that you are doing the right things. You're doing your homework, you're doing, you know, your workouts, and, you know, good things happen to those who to do the right steps. And so that's sort of all that's what I try to do, at least.
The greatest challenges offer the greatest rewards, and how we meet that reveals the truth in all of us.
Yeah.
And that completely opened my eyes.
You know, it was a poster that hung above my bed for years. You know, I think I always explored the question when I was a kid of who am I, right? And who do I want to be, and what am I become? Because you're sitting there at, you know, 18, 19, you know, 20, 16 years, I don't know, whatever the age that is of your maturation, you're trying to understand, where's my place in this world? What am I doing? Where am I going? And, you know, I think that I was lucky that I had that determination, right? And that determination through my rowing career. And then once that rowing career was finished, I didn't say like, wow, look how great I am. You know, I said, okay, well, what's next? You know, there's another chapter in this game, and yes, fueled by the sport, I gotta finance myself. I gotta you know, feed myself. And so, you know, it was a natural extension of what I'm gonna do. And part of that was always in the back of my brain while I was rowing. You know, I think that, again, I go back to, you know, what helped me be so successful in the working world was those same lessons that I applied from rowing, and just that sort of dogged determination that I was going to succeed no matter what, right? And there was only one way to do it. And, you know, I'd seen the blueprint, right? The blueprint was right in front of me, and I'd lived it. You know, I just had to transfer that blueprint into a next career in life. And so I feel pretty lucky that I've done that. And, you know, to I don't know, cap it off with the fact that they made a movie of what we did. I don't know. I just sort of very blessed and lucky that, I don't even know how I walked into that one, but, you know, pretty neat.
One of the questions in the Q&A was thoughts on having the camera crew follow you guys through the Olympic selection in 2000. So, yeah.
I think at the time, you don't really even think about it. You know, they're there, but it's just sort of just noise. You know, you think about it like the today's professional athlete has, you know, cameras on them 24/7. You just hope you're not try to say as many stupid things as you can possibly, you know, say. So thankfully a lot of that's got cut, but, you know, when you go back and you see stuff in there, you're like, oh geez, you know, but yeah.
Was it hard to keep yourself afloat when you were on the national team, like financially?
You know, I'm very blessed. I grew up and my parents were, you know, had money. And so I was able to do that. But, you know, one of the things I tell about my mother, I graduated from college, and, you know, she goes to me, Porter, congratulations. You know, I said, okay, great. And she goes, you know, you're now on your own. You're no longer any support from your mom and dad. And so, you know, at the time I was like, what the hell, you know? But, you know, it was one of the best things that, you know, my mother could have ever done, in that, you know, okay, let's go, you know, time, you know, like, she's right. You know, I'm not going to be babied by anything. And so, you know, I worked after college. You know, I always worked while I was rowing as well. And, you know, was motivated by that and, you know, to be able to at least put food on the table and pay the rent and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you know, the rowing stipends are not going to cover itself, nor should they. Like, it's not rowing is not a it's not a spectator sport. There's not a lot of money in it. It's a self-satisfaction sport. And for the few people that like us that really love it, you know, that's about it. And, you know, it's not going to draw the big money to, you know, to say I'm going to row and do nothing else. And so, of course, you're going to have to support yourself. It's sort of obvious. And that might not be the case in Europe, but who cares? That's not where we live, right? There's too much other sports that the NIL money in college. Maybe it finds rowing. I doubt it. It will, but not to the same extent that it does other places. So I lived it. And I was in the Olympic team after my sophomore year in college. You know, none of it ever found me. There's no money there. So
yeah, I know that Chip talked about some of the guys wanted to be models. They got paid from that. I don't know if you were involved in that or whatnot.
That's Ben Holbrook, Jamie Coven, Jim Neal. I think Josh Crosby of Apple Fitness was also in that too, I think. But yeah, good for them. There should be more rowing sponsorship because it does give off unbelievable meaning of what the sport, you know, symbolizes. But
sure,
you know, it hasn't commercially appeared yet. So we'll hopefully it'll happen one day.
Yeah, the movie's coming out on Christmas Day. Are you excited about that?
I think it's going to probably change the sport more than people think it will.
How?
In the United States, having been part of The Big Short and the process, and, you know, the movie was owned by Brad Pitt, I don't think people appreciate the amount of dollars that go into the advertising campaign, that go into, you know, how big mainstream media is. And, you know, this is a Clooney movie, right?
Yeah.
George Clooney. And listen, he's a big time director. These movies do not fail. There is too much money behind it to let it fail. And so I think the movie will be bigger than people think it is.
I think it's going to bring more people to the sport, and that's going to, you think so too or no?
It has to.
Yeah.
It has to. I mean, look at the, how many people come up to me and, oh, you read Boys in the Boat. You know, the amount of people that read, watch movies over books is like, you know, 1,000x. You know, I can count on my hand the number of people who read The Big Short, but the people have watched the movie, you know, everybody.
Yeah. It's like Harry Potter. Like, everyone knows Harry Potter, Star Wars, like those big, you know, series and whatnot. And I'm a huge fan of both of them. But anyways,
no one read First Blood, but they all watched Rambo, you know, so there you go.
Yeah. Last couple questions here. I know you have lots of things to do. If there's something that you have to say to people out there who are struggling to, you know, get a faster erg or to make it to the next level, any type of things that you wish you would have known back in the day or have told yourself?
I guess I'm consistent. There's no magic potion to get faster on the erg or getting a better rower. It's just hard work, you know, and it's up to you to do it. You know, it's up to you to, you know, get up early when you can sleep in, or, you know, maybe not go out as late at night as you want to, or, you know, in high school, or, you know, not drink when everyone else is drinking. You know, I didn't have a sip of alcohol until college. You know, I was and then even when I was growing in the national team, I talk about it. It was a very monastic type lifestyle. You know, we didn't party. You know, it's a lot of work. You know, if you want to do that, great, you're going to succeed. If you don't want to do that, you know, like, find something else, right? And it's sort of that simple. And if you want to put in the hard work, the results will show.
Certainly. And there's
my son he'd gone to a qualification regatta, junior national championships
trials, or, yeah.
And he was a freshman in high school last year, and he was in the single, and you know, he'd lost a couple guys, and you know, he was motivated to get better, right? And so sure enough, he put in the hard work, trained, and comes back this year and beat all the guys that had beat him last spring, and sort of occurred to him, it's like, hey, you know, work hard equals results. And, you know, the light bulb goes off that I can do this. And the same thing happened to me. And, you know, it's a little bit harder, I guess, in an eight, man to see the or eight person boat to see those results. But if you get those training partners and if you get those teammates and you bring them along and you're a leader and you sort of, you know, get that, you know, atmosphere where, hey, we got the ball rolling in the right direction and we can do things and you know, we can really change the speed we're in and we work hard, you know, like I think it works. Right.
There's a little bit of a new technique now where they're essentially almost like a gather at the finish and they're staying there.
I don't understand that, but that's just me. I think it actually doesn't make any intuitive sense to me at all, but it's whatever.
Which part of the rowing stroke do you think is the most important?
Well, in the 8th, obviously it's the catch, but I don't understand the super serious pause at the finish. I've always started to get the hands out when you can and then float on the recovery, not right. The pause here, rush up to the catch, but whatever. What do I know?
You know a lot though. So there's another thing too. Anyone that's interested in being in stocks, obviously the economy is dog shit. No offense to anybody out there, but it's dog shit now. I mean, hopefully it'll get better. What type of things do you like about it?
My fascination with it early on was just the instant feedback. It sadly, it reminded myself of an erg that, you know, you know, you would get the scoreboard every day right in front of you. Unlike rowing, the harder the output, the harder the work, sometimes the results don't show. It obviously is more of a thinking person's game. But I just got enamored with the markets and the nonstop, constant nature of it. It's very, fits my personality very well. And you know, I'm too nice of a guy to do private equity and negotiate deals. And, you know, with at least with trading stocks, the price I want to pay is right in front of the screen. I can't haggle with it. If I don't like it, don't buy it. If I like it, I buy it. So that's as simple as that.
That's great. Athletes are getting crazy fast, like crazy fast. You talked about Cal's 8. All those guys are like, they can take, they have so much depth on their program, like that they can take guys from the 2V and make it into a 1V that, you know, other programs that are competing against are, you know, are at. So
I don't think that's new necessarily. I mean, I think just different programs have different, you know, waves of strength, you know, like where, you know, Yale looked like they were unbeatable 5 or 6 years ago, you know, Brown looked like they were unbeatable in, you know, the late 90s, you know, Princeton, you know, has looked unbeatable at times, you know. So, you know, all these programs go through ebbs and flows of success. You know, I think that if I was a young kid, I would really look to see, you know, which coach inspires me, right? Who, whether you're on the women's or men's program, which coach is going to make me a better person. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously looking around of seeing the people on the team, you know, do I fit in with these people? Are they like-minded with me? You know, that helps. And then, you know, it's in some ways we're all just lucky that get into a fantastic school like the you know, the whole rowing universe has these amazing universities. So I think it's a real ticket. I think it's and a real gift to be able to do it. I would say in the late 90s we had just this unbelievable group of talent out there. You know, sadly we didn't win as many medals as we should have, but you know, sometimes you just get a group of people, of exceptional athletes, exceptional leaders, and that really take it to the next level. And I think that ebbs and flows and times can change quickly, right? You, if you are that person and you bring in that you know, those other athletes with you, you know, you can flip the script pretty quickly in terms of going from a really bad program to a good program quickly. Look what happened to Brown. They were terrible. And then, you know, Jamie Coven and Zeno Mueller show up and, you know, all of a sudden they're unbeatable. You know, same thing with Chris Ahrens and Marty Crotty. Same thing. They went from bad to unbelievable.
Unreal. There's a someone, I think Casey Galbenik, he's the coach at Sarasota. He told me, he goes, he had asked one of the Michael Callahan, one of his athletes that was, you know, undefeated and did some great things. And he'd asked, when he met the athlete, Casey asked him, he said, you know, what did you get out of it? And the guy just was like, it was okay. Like there, it was just okay. There wasn't anything about it. But I'm curious to know if you
what was what was okay?
Just rowing. Yeah, rowing at a high level. There was this. He just felt like it was just okay.
rowing is it's a gift, right? It's a gift for young kids. It's a gift for old people like myself these days to, you know, stay fit and stay healthy. It's, you know, it's a good sport for the mind. And, you know, people talk about, you know, sports you can do your whole life. Rowing you can, right? You're not gonna be able to play football your whole life. And, you know, I feel blessed that I'm approaching 50 years old and super fit, healthy, and you know, feel good about life.
That's great. Well, Porter, it was a blessing to have you on today. Appreciate you for taking the time out of day to talk to me and being on the show. I hope to have you on down the line when things get a little bit better. Maybe I have my own studio or whatnot. But been a great time talking. Thank you so much.
Well, I love it and appreciate your tenacity and shows you're going to be a pretty successful coxswain in the future. So good stuff.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good one.